welcome to this week's Talking History. This is Brian Laveau of Creighton University's Department of History, your host for today's program. In a few minutes, for the principal segment of our show, Dennis Mihalik will be speaking with Professor Ellen Dubois on the Women's Rights Convention held in Seneca Falls, New York, 150 years ago. But first, let's look back at this week, July 13th through the 19th, in history. On July 14, 1789, the French Revolution began with the fall of the Bastille. On July 15, 1968, soap enthusiasts heralded the debut of ABC's One Life to Live. On July 16, 1790, Washington, D.C. was named the nation's capital. A Frenchman, Pierre L'Enfant, would spend the next 10 years planning and building the city. On July 18, 1976, Nadia Comăneci, a tiny 14-year-old from Romania, claimed the first perfect score of 10 in the history of Olympic gymnastics. On July 19, 1984, the Democratic Party nominated Geraldine Ferraro as its candidate for vice president. She is the only woman in U.S. history to be nominated by a major political party for the seat. Ferraro and Walter Mondale, the Democratic presidential candidate, lost to the GOP's Reagan-Bush ticket. For this week's History in the News segment, we return to the May-June issue of American Heritage magazine and its list of the most overrated and underrated whatever in history. The editors asked dozens of experts whom they considered the most overrated and underrated in their respective fields. The list is fascinating but lengthy, so let me list for you just some of the more interesting winners or losers. The most overrated automobile in American history, the 1955 Ford Thunderbird. The most underrated, the Ford Model T. The most overrated criminal in American history, Benedict Arnold. The most underrated, Ted Bundy. The abolition of corsets in the early years of this century is listed as the most overrated fashion trend in American history. The shortening of skirts shortly thereafter is considered the most underrated. Lucy Hayes is considered the most overrated first lady. The most underrated, Florence Harding. The most overrated founding father, Thomas Jefferson. The most underrated, John Adams. Well, how about the most overrated general in American history? Robert E. Lee. The most underrated, Ulysses Grant. The most overrated holiday, according to American Heritage, is Arbor Day. With apologies to my fellow Nebraskans, the most underrated is Father's Day. Sliced bread is listed as the most overrated invention. The most underrated, the Brunswick Mineralite bowling ball. The most overrated movie in American history is It's a Wonderful Life. The most underrated, Advise and Consent. American Heritage lists Elvis Presley as the most overrated musician in American history, and Louis Armstrong as the most underrated. The most overrated turning point in American history, the Treaty of Versailles, ending World War I. The most underrated, the GI Bill of Rights passed after World War II. And finally, according to American Heritage, the most overrated politician in American history is Confederate President Jefferson Davis. The most underrated is Richard Nixon. An interesting choice indeed. For a complete list of American Heritage's most overrated and underrated in American history, see its May-June issue. You're listening to Talking History. The women's rights movement in the United States has a long and venerable history. In 1998, we celebrate the 150th anniversary of the first major event in that history, the Seneca Falls Convention of 1848. Here to interview our guest historian on that convention is fellow Creighton historian Dennis Mihalik.
Thank you, Brian. 150 years ago, in July of 1848, about 300 people attended the first of its kind feminist convention at Seneca Falls, New York. The meeting published the Seneca Falls Declaration that listed grievances and resolved to pursue equality for women. Here today, to put the events and the issues into perspective, is our guest, Dr. Ellen Carroll Dubois, currently a professor of history at UCLA and the author of several books on feminism, the latest being Woman Suffrage and Women's Rights, available this summer from the New York University Press. Welcome, Dr. Du Bois.
Hi. Can I correct you? There's actually another book I want to push.
Okay.
Can I push that?
Yes.
It's called Harriet Sandblast and the Winning of Woman Suffrage. And it's a biography that's currently available from Yale University Press.
Yale University Press.
Right.
Okay. Now, the first obvious question is, why was the meeting held at Seneca Falls?
Well, the answer is simple, that the leading, the woman whose insights and drive really lay at the heart of this meeting, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, lived in Seneca Falls. It was and is a small industrial town right on the Erie Canal. In the middle of what was then called, in the middle of upstate New York, what was then called the Burned Over District, which referred not to forest fires, but to evangelical religious excitement, revivals, and then what followed in their wake, a whole series of reform activist movements, including spiritualism, anti-slavery, and finally women's rights. And that's where Elizabeth Stanton had gone with her growing family of, at this point, maybe four boys. She was going to have three more children after that. And her husband, who was establishing a law practice and working to push anti-slavery issues into the politics of New York. And with her father's help, she got a small house in this, I wouldn't call it sleepy, but she'd come from Boston. So Seneca Falls was in Boston, and it was a hard shift for her. She was used to the sophistication of the urban center.
Okay. Now, I understand that there was a close connection between the anti-slavery movement and then the burgeoning women's rights movement.
Yes, there couldn't be a closer connection. I really think that the, not just anti-slavery, but a particular form of anti-slavery, the radical abolitionist, which called for the immediate uncompensated abolition of slavery, was the context in which women's rights occurred. And I don't think it's possible to really understand the rise of feminism in the United States in this period without understanding the atmosphere and the commitment that reformers had to the abolitionist movement. In particular, let me say two parts of that. One is that the abolitionist movement, under the leadership of William Lloyd Garrison, really established an egalitarian political atmosphere that was crucial to women's rights. An atmosphere first developed with respect to race, in which the difference between black and white was argued of no significance at the higher level of moral obligation. And similarly, women's rights activists have said the same thing about male and female, that, as they would say, we are neither black nor white, male nor female in the eyes of God, and therefore in the moral obligations of how we live our lives in daily life. That's one impact that abolitionism had. The other is that women were very, very, very involved in abolitionism, in part because it was seen as a moral imperative. And women understood themselves to have responsibility for moral life from around them. So these two coincidences, the involvement of women activists and the emphasis on equal rights, are really the fertile soil in which women's rights grew in the abolitionist environment.
Okay. Now, there were about 300 participants. How would you describe, say, the average participant at the Seneca Falls Conference?
Well, the average participant wasn't a very average person. The average participant was probably somebody who was involved in some of the more radical religious and political activities of the day. In particular, there was a large group of radical Quakers who, it's not just the Quakers, which already took them a little bit outside of the mainstream of Methodist and Presbyterian life in mid-state New York, but they had broken off from the mainstream of the Quaker community because they felt that it had it was not sufficiently on guard against the intrusion of the effects of slavery. For instance, these would be the kind of people who would make sure that the clothes they wore and the food they ate did not involve any products made by the hands of slaves. In other words, slave-grown cotton or slave-grown sugar.
Mm-hmm.
So these are, for the most part, radical Quakers. They were not wealthy. They were sort of middle class, tended to be slightly agrarian, live in small towns, and journeyed to the convention in their farmer's wagon. Now, that's the average participant. They also were probably involved with, think, third parties that were beginning to develop in this period, particularly the Free Soil Party, which eventually grew into the Republican Party. So they were reform activists and religious enthusiasts.
Mm-hmm. Now, some men also participated in that convention?
Yes, a fair number of men participated. You probably have the numbers in front of you. They seem to have participated. One of the things that historians have realized is that they came in family groups. So husbands and wives, sisters, families came together to participate. Of the men that we know, some of them were very prominent in these political abolitionist efforts of the period. But there were definitely men and women there together. In fact, the meeting itself was chaired by a man because no woman was yet confident enough to stand before a public audience and run a meeting. So that the meeting itself was chaired by the husband of Lucretia Mott, who was the sort of leading woman abolitionist in this period, and her husband ran the meetings or chaired the meetings.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so then we have Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Lucretia Mott, two of the most famous women of the era.
Let me just say one thing about Elizabeth Stanton.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't fit this profile. She wasn't a Quaker. She wasn't a middle class, sort of lower middle class person, and she was an agrarian. She was sort of a Presbyterian or Episcopal, I'm not sure which, more high church. She came from a wealthy background. Her mother's family was quite wealthy. She had a very fine education, and she was somewhat different in her background than the Quakers who formed the majority of the participants.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But then I was going to say, besides those two very famous women of the era, were there any other guiding spirits of the convention?
I actually don't know too much about the details. We actually don't know too much about, or I don't know too much about other individuals. There were a handful of other women who helped to write the declaration. The other women's names were Mary Ann McClintock, Amy Post, and Catherine Stebbins, who were also abolitionist women. And we know about one or two others who left us a little bit of information. But for the most part, these women and men who helped the support event happen, this was their historical contribution. This is how we know them.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, they met, and on July 19th, 1848, they issued the Seneca Falls Declaration of Sentiments and Resolutions.
Right.
That is, It's a short two-page document that...
Well, it has three parts, actually. Its first part is its prologue, which is drawn, as I'm sure you'll want to talk about, directly from the Declaration of Independence. Then it's a series of grievances, the number of which was meant to equal the number of grievances in the Declaration of Independence. And then there are a series of resolutions. So there are sort of a description of the aspects of women's oppression, the basic principles, the description of women's oppression, and then the goals of this men.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so to belabor the obvious, the Seneca Falls Declaration, as you said, mirrors the Declaration of Independence.
Right.
Okay, so I mean, they actually took the language of the Declaration of Independence and followed it very closely?
They followed it extremely closely, and this is both sort of clever and extremely ambitious move on their part. It's clever because it locates their demands in the most legitimate and revered political tradition available, that of the American Revolution. And yet it's extremely ambitious because it uses these revered notions to explore an entirely new notion, which is that, let's see if I can find the language, after a long set of paragraphs that virtually echo the Declaration of Independence, with a few exceptions, such as, we hold these truths to be self-evident that all men and women are created equal.
Yes, an obvious declaration.
Obvious amendment. But then we get to a paragraph that's their contribution after having sort of followed the declaration. They write, the history of mankind is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations on the part of man towards woman, having a direct object, the establishment of an absolute tyranny over her. That's the last paragraph of the introduction. And it's a very radical statement indeed, which equates man's tyranny over woman with, the King of England's tyranny over the colonies.
Yes. And then, as you say, it continues the mirror image by listing a series of grievances.
Yes.
How would you classify these grievances? Obviously, there's a series of them, and as we look at them in what they're complaining about, how would you characterize their complaints?
Well, there are a lot of, they're very rich, and like all great historical documents, you can't get to the bottom of them in one reading. But this time that I read them, sometimes they're described as going from law to social practice to social sense. That's one way they're described. Actually, when I looked at it this time, what struck me was that they follow, the first set of grievances has to do with the impact of marriage on women. And then the second set of grievances has to do with what happens to women outside of marriage. So that together they form an indictment of the way that women are trapped in a subordination that's based in marriage, and when they try to live outside of it, independent of marriage, they find that impossible. So that's the sort of overall framework.
Yes, when I read it for the interview, I was struck by how much it reminded me of the statement that the National Organization of Women would make in 1966.
Well, why don't you tell me where you see that? I'd be interested.
Well, I mean, in terms of their understanding in the mid-19th century of how the position of marriage trapped women.
Right, I see what you're saying.
See, in that sense.
Yes, well, I think that's right. I think that there is a deep and not fully excavated tradition in or aspect of the feminist tradition, which really concentrates on the nature of marriage as the source of women, as an institution, not individual marriages, but the structure, the institutional structures of marriage, and then, of course, the institutional structures of women's lives outside of marriage that shape their subordination. So I agree with you there.
Mm-hmm. In the minutes that we have left, when you look at what women said we needed to be equal in 1848, in the 150 years that we've had to search for this equality, how much have we achieved in reaching the goals stated in the resolutions here?
Well, I went over those. I did. I also prepared myself. And I thought that they really fell into two categories, but some of these are very dated. For instance, here's one. Resolved that inasmuch as man, while claiming for himself intellectual superiority, accords to women moral superiority, it is preeminently his duty to encourage her to speak and teach if she has an opportunity in all religious assemblies. Now, it is, I think, that this issue of intellectual superiority still obtains, but this notion that women are assumed to be morally superior, that's something that we don't really recognize as part of modern life. On the other hand, let me read one that it seems to me to be as strong now as it was then, that the women of this country ought to be enlightened in regard to the laws under which they live, that they may no longer publish their degradation by declaring themselves satisfied with their present position, or their ignorance by asserting that they have all the rights they want. I think that in reading this, in sort of characterizing the resolutions in these two two ways, ones that are historically specific and ones that seem to transcend history. This reminds us that we always, when we look at the history of feminism, we have a sort of double task before us. On the one hand, of course, we want to understand what still remains as a challenge in terms of women's equality. That women's equality, I think of almost as a horizon that as you approach it, recedes or takes a different shape. On the other hand, it would really do a disservice to history not to understand how much has changed and how much the absence of these and other women have really achieved for us, how much they've changed the circumstances of women's lives. So I would really sort of end with a plea that we understand that that we need to encompass in our understanding of history both the continuities in women's demands and the changes in terms of the achievements of now many generations of women.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Well, that's all the time we have for this interview. We have been talking with Dr. Ellen Carol DuBois, professor of history at UCLA, about the Seneca Falls Convention of 1848.
For this week's radio op-ed piece, we continue on the subject of the women's rights movement and the anniversary of Seneca Falls. Providing her historical perspective on that convention is Vivian Rose, historian at the Women's Rights National Historical Park in Seneca Falls, New York.
This July, groups from around the country and the world will come to Seneca Falls, New York to celebrate the 150th anniversary of the first Women's Rights Convention. The Wesleyan Methodist Chapel, where the convention took place, forms the centerpiece of Women's Rights National Historical Park. Created by Congress in 1980 to preserve and interpret the buildings associated with the struggle of women for their equal rights, the park will join with Seneca Falls residents to host exhibits, programs, performances, rallies, and visits from high-level state and federal male and female elected officials and representatives. The impulse to look back and to plot for the future, however, is no modern invention. In 1898, 83-year-old Elizabeth Cady Stanton, an organizer and leader of the July 1848 Women's Rights Convention, looked back to assess progress made. The results both delighted and disturbed her. Demands for the right to vote, for liberal divorce laws, and for access to the professions in the pulpit, she noted, require no great courage now. Changes in social customs and laws, and the extension to women of some forms of the vote, demonstrated that the Seneca Falls Convention, condemned at the time as a grave mistake, was in fact a grand step in progress. Still, Stanton felt impelled to reiterate my demands for justice, liberty, and equality in the church as well as in the state. By 1923, women had gained the right to vote throughout the United States. Alice Paul and her followers in the most radical and confrontational wing of the suffrage movement had hosted parades through Washington, D.C., chained themselves to the White House fence, and staged hunger strikes when jailed. At celebrations held in Seneca Falls of the 75th anniversary of the first Women's Rights Convention, Alice Paul unveiled her program for the future, an amendment to the Constitution of the United States guaranteeing that equality of rights under the law would be granted to women. 1948 marks the adoption of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights by the General Assembly of the United Nations after active lobbying of heads of state by the former First Lady and committed civil rights leader Eleanor Roosevelt. It also marks the centennial of the Seneca Falls Convention. Dorothy Kenyon, U.S. Representative to the UN Commission on the Status of Women, delivered the keynote speech at celebrations in Seneca Falls. Today is not meant for complacency over past achievements, great as these may have been, she said, but for ways and means of implementing human freedom for the future. We must have more and many more qualified women in all posts of government. Susan B. Anthony II, great niece of the 19th century reformer, offered a declaration of the women of 1948 to the women of 2048, in which notable authors and activists promised to work unceasingly for the liberation of womankind and mankind from poverty, disease, and war, and to liberate our sex and various races from the economic, political, and social bonds that still cripple us 100 years after the women of 1848 started their long battle to loosen them. It remains to be seen what calls for the future will emanate from Seneca Falls this July. But one thing is certain. This anniversary, like every previous one, will be used to assess the past and set agendas for the future. There is still work to be done.
You've been listening to Vivian Rose, historian at the Women's Rights National Historical Park in Seneca Falls, New York. And finally, our list of coming attractions, upcoming films, television programs, museum exhibits, or anything else that may be of interest to our listeners. July 26th is the last day to catch a series of Gold Rush exhibits at the Oakland Museum of California. Three exhibits, collectively titled Gold Fever, California's Untold Stories, boast more than 1,000 artifacts, paintings, and drawings from the mid-19th century westward surge. And if Leonardo DiCaprio and Kate Winslet got you thinking about the early 20th century maritime tragedy, the Newport News Virginia Mariners Museum is offering a special exhibit, Titanic, Fortune, and Fate. The exhibition runs through November 1st and offers historical photographs and artifacts from the day the Titanic was launched, a day in the life of the Titanic's craftsmen who prepared the accommodations aboard the luxury liner, letters from survivors, and a multimedia display on the Titanic's passengers and crew. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed the show. We invite you to send us your comments or suggestions for future programs, either by email at talkinghistory, all one word, at creighton.edu, or send them along by regular mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History, at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Until next time, from Creighton University, this is Brian LeBeau.